Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, I'm Nick Cheeseman, and ordinarily I host the New Books in Southeast Asian Studies channel on the New Books Network. But today I'm pleased to inaugurate a new special series on New Books in Interpretive Social Science. In these episodes, we'll be featuring books on interpretive methods and methodologies alternately with exemplars of new interpretive inquiry. To get the ball rolling, I have online not one but both of the editors of the Routledge series on interpretive methods, who are also co-authors of the first book in that series, Interpretive Research Design, Concepts and Processes, which was published in 2012. They are Peregrine Schwartzsche, Professor of Political Science at the University of Utah in the US, and Devorah Janau, Professor of Social Science at Wageningen University in the Netherlands. Though their institutions are far apart, fortunately, the two of them are in the same place, just out of teaching a class in Budapest. Peri, Devorah, welcome, and thanks so much for agreeing to get this new special series of the New Books Network underway.
Thank you, Nick. It's a delight to be able to talk with you, and thank you for the idea of launching this series.
It's great to be here, Nick.
What are interpretive methods, and why do we need a book series, let alone this podcast series, on them?
Interpretive methods are a way to focus on how people understand their worlds. So as a research method, it takes the meaning-making of the people studied and puts it at the center of the research project. And this is really important because there are other research approaches that tend to be very distant from the people studied. And if you want to understand how people make sense of their worlds, interpretive methods are the most appropriate way to go.
And why we need a book series for it touches on the politics of science as much as on anything else. Sage already had a so-called blue book series devoted to qualitative methods, but they didn't take up the methodological issues. We find it very important to think in terms of ontological and epistemological presuppositions about the research that we do. That is, what's the reality status of what we're doing, and how can that social reality be known? And so there are distinctions that we draw between qualitative methods and interpretive methods, reflecting respectively positivist methodological presuppositions and phenomenological hermeneutic presuppositions. So we wanted a series of books that put all of that front and center, and then showed how to translate those more abstract or philosophical ideas into research practices. And so we thought that having a series would give a certain visibility to the methodological ideas as well as to the methods and to the people doing them. And we wanted to design a series that would do that both on the basis of different disciplines and disciplinary subfields, and on the methodological and methods issues entailed.
The other component was to make the books thin, something that you could read in a single sitting if you were so inclined, so that someone did not have to invest reading a 300-page book or asking their students to buy a 300-page book, but instead they could read about ethnography or about interpretive research design in a way that would familiarize them with it, and they could slip it into their method syllabus and spend a couple weeks on it
without redesigning the whole course.
So this goes some way towards questions of readership and hopefully listenership. Could you say a bit more about who you're hoping to attract?
Well, obviously the students, the graduate students in particular, but also even senior scholars. So if you are thinking of a new project and you say to yourself, what analytic technique should I use? One way to familiarize yourself as a senior scholar is to pick up one of these books, and then you'll have a sense of whether it will make sense for your project or whether you should move on to something else.
And as well, faculty can use the books with their graduate students, the graduate students they're advising, but doctoral students can also use the books in the reverse direction when they find themselves in a situation where they want to do some form of interpretive methodological work, and the faculty member says, what's that?
And in our ideal world, editors would be reading these books, editors of journals and presses.
So that they are not judging manuscripts that they review according to criteria or evaluative standards that apply to different methods than the ones that are the focus of the books and or article manuscripts that they're reviewing.
I'd like to hold that thought for a moment and come to the question of standards shortly. Before we do that, how did you come to be editors of this series and authors of this book? What in your backgrounds made you especially interested to pursue this question of what interpretive methods are and how they might be taught and communicated about more effectively?
Part of the story is how different Devorah and I are in terms of our background and training. So I was trained as a quantitative, experimental, rational choice person in graduate school, and I became very frustrated with the whole approach and then moved towards feminist analysis and started searching beyond that as well, and ran into Devorah at a conference.
Tell the story about the women's encampment.
So I was a young PhD and I heard about a group of activists at the Women's Encampment for a Future of Peace and Justice outside of Seneca, New York, who were protesting the transshipment of nuclear weapons to Europe. And it was a women-only encampment, so women and boys under 12, and the men were to serve in supportive roles. And I went in with my rational choice framework, but I started reading How Feminists Think About the World and their critiques. And that was one of the things that started to move me away from a positivist framework in which the identity of the researcher is not theorized or thought to be important, which is an important part of interpretive methods generally, that those who do the research, their identity affects how they ask the questions, how they do the research, and may even ultimately affect the conclusions drawn in the research. But that gets theorized actively in interpretive research.
And that experience kind of posed an intellectual crisis for you, yes?
Eventually. First I got tenure, and then I completed this journey through feminist research to interpretive methods. So there are ways in which part of my motivation always was to give graduate students the choices that I didn't have in my graduate education.
And that's about the point where we met. You had tenure and you were taking that transition. I had started, when I got my undergraduate degree in politics, which is what my university called its department, I went off and worked for 3 years as a community organizer. I came out of that work experience back into graduate school, a master's degree for 1 year, and then a couple of years later, I started a PhD, and my PhD research was trying to explain what I had found in the field, because the policy implementation literature that I was reading in graduate school didn't help me make sense of that experience. And it was in trying to parse that experience that I came to understand that there was not one single way of understanding policy implementation, the equivalent in policy studies, perhaps, to rational choice theory at the time was cost-benefit analysis, which is done equally at arm's length distance from people experiencing the public policy. And that was my intellectual crisis, so to say, that the theories I had been reading and studying and had been being taught didn't fit my lived experience. And that opened for me the door to multiple possible interpretations of policy events and documents and so forth, which itself is at the heart of an interpretive approach. That is the notion that we don't live in a singular social reality, but rather in multiple social realities. And so fast forward until each of us has tenure, I think, and we had been going to the Western U.S. Political Science Association meetings regularly. We knew each other there from the Women's Caucus breakfast meetings. We succeeded each other as president of that association. And at one of those meetings, post-presidential service, we had lunch together and ended up talking about research methods textbooks and asked each other, I wonder what those textbooks are doing when they announce themselves as research methods in political science. And we both went down to the book display area at that meeting. And then Perry went to the book display area at the subsequent American Political Science Association meeting. And to make a longer story shorter, we ended up publishing our first joint article, which is called Reading Methods Texts, each one of those words in scare quotes, where we did basically a kind of literary analysis of the textbooks, looking at the metaphors they used and how much page length weight they gave to each different kind of method. And that was really the origins of this. The article was published in 2002. In 2005, the Western Political Science Association met in Oakland, California. I was the local arrangements chair, and I had an opportunity then to institute a new kind of program. What we did was call the thing the Methods Cafe. We didn't call it the Interpretive Methods Cafe. That's part of our politics of science. But we started then with a series of discussion tables, each table focused on a different kind of interpretive method. We brought it a few months later to the American Political Science Association and ran the thing since 2005. And everything else grew out of that. And in the interim, we started engaging in all kinds of different activities around interpretive methods. And it just seemed at some point as a logical extension of that to run a book series.
So let's get back into the contents of the book and pick up with that earlier point you raised about standards, Devorah. One of the contributions of the book is that it offers this conceptual vocabulary, as you put it, for doing interpretive social scientific work. Before we continue, it would be good to be clear about why this alternative conceptual vocabulary is needed and why it's such an integral element of the book, since it cuts against a prevailing idea, particularly in some quarters of political science, that social scientists have a single set of standards and a single set of terms to go with them, that diverse methods and tools are okay, but diverse terms and standards are not. What are you aiming to do with this conceptual vocabulary? Are there any risks associated with it? Are you trying to cause a schism in the social scientific community, perhaps, that could undermine faith in the larger social scientific project?
There is an educational theme that runs through everything that we've done, including this book. Perry touched on that before when she talked about making opportunities available to her students that she had not had herself. I was not at a university where I had doctoral students, and so my sight was set on the graduate students I encountered at the American Political Science Association meetings primarily, and then as I moved over to Europe, the graduate students I was meeting in these various method schools, summer and winter, where I've been teaching. And what animated that book and the effort to try to make a translation possible across different ways of thinking about research was this desire to enable doctoral students to talk with those, whether these be researchers or their own advisors or others in their departments who would challenge them, saying things like, but ethnography is not scientific, or your work is not reliable, or how can you generalize based on that? So that's where the idea of engaging in this kind of translation of concepts emerged. Were we trying to introduce a schism? No, I think we were recognizing that the schism was already there, and we wanted to try to do something to make life better for those who are on the receiving end of these kinds of negative, battering even comments about the work that they were doing.
Yeah, two things. One is that sometimes people would pick up our book and say, oh, this is what I've been doing all along. Now I have the vocabulary to express it. And so that new vocabulary was intentional because I was very frustrated teaching a research design course to look at the standard research design chapters that would begin with the experimental method. Call it the gold standard. And there was no room within that vocabulary or in those chapters for a research approach that centers the meaning making of those studied. And so that frustration was to say, okay, research design is a course that is often taught, and it prepares people to write proposals either for a dissertation or for a grant proposal. And people need an authoritative source that they can cite, and they need language that will not confuse people. Because if you say sampling, your readers' minds go to positivist random sampling. And so that word will send mixed signals about what you're doing. Whereas if you talk about selection of sites, your reader will not be confused. So we talked a lot about which words to keep, which words to change. We kept science because there is a tradition of interpretive social science, and we knew that we had to claim science for legitimacy's sake, and we do think it is scientific. Mm-hmm. Whenever you introduce new vocabulary, the question is, will it take off? So when we get to the discussion about standards, I think some of the vocabulary that is introduced is well known and is successful. Others we've kind of reconsidered over time a little bit.
Let me pick up on this point about the scientific character of interpretive inquiry, because in the opening chapter, you emphasize that there are two central hallmarks of scientific practice that you want to bring into the discussion of research design. So first, what is commonly called rigor, you call systematicity, and second, testability, you associate in interpretive research methods with constant reflexive questioning. What are the differences between these, and why draw the reader's attention to them in order to underscore the scientific quality of interpretive research methods?
You know, it occurs to me that one of the experiences that prompted all of this was going to a panel at the Western Political Science Association meeting in which Timothy Pacherat presented his field research in a U.S.-based slaughterhouse for the first time. And he did this lovely presentation of his ethnographic data and his preliminary inferences drawn from those data. And then it came time for the questions from the audience. And this one somewhat older gentleman said to him, but I'm confused. I can't tell what your dependent and independent variables are. And Timothy might have been expecting all kinds of other questions, but that was one he hadn't expected. In thinking about how to answer that kind of challenge and that kind of question, we came to this notion that all science is systematic and that it's done with an attitude of doubt, the constant questioning, how do I know if I've got this right, or what if I'm wrong?
Let me take this in a slightly different direction. And that is the idea that you can do empirical research without variables. And when you say that to social scientists who have been primarily trained in positivist and statistical analysis, they look at you and their mouth drops open. How can you do research without variables? And that is part of what this book is designed to do, is to convince people that you can have a scientific method that engages empirical materials, that doesn't have to chop up the world into variables and then reassemble them. You can draw conclusions from empirical evidence in a more holistic fashion than that approach to knowledge. Because after all, it's very artificial. It's hardly phenomenological. You're taking experience and chopping it up and then putting the variables into your regression equation. And sometimes it pushes human meaning-making to the margins of the research project.
Here's another way of building on that answer and tying it into your question, Nick. I had been teaching courses in interpretive methodology and methods for about 15 years before the Interpretive Research Design book was published. In thinking about how to teach that and how to advance the argument that interpretive research is or can be scientific, it became important to me to ask the question, what is science? And then to take an historical approach and ask, where did science come from? How did it emerge? When did it emerge? That took me back to the medieval times, not to argue that there were not sciences in the ancient world, but our scientific apparatus today draws on developments in Europe. So if you look to the European history, and you go back to feudal times, when there was a relationship between the serfs and the landowner going up the ranks to the king. When something went wrong in the serf's field, there was hail and it killed all of the crops, the serf might take that question either to the local land manager or to the parish priest, why did this happen? And if it was the parish priest would likely say, you sinned and God is punishing you. Science emerges out of that, which is what makes systematicity a reasonable answer, as well as the attitude of doubt or the reflexive questioning. Because when we talk about challenges of faith in the context of religion, that's not the kind of doubting or testability that we think of when we think about it in scientific practices. During the Renaissance, when Copernicus and Galileo and Sir Isaac Newton start challenging the received wisdom of the church, the whole revolution there says, when you have the question of why something happened in your field, you don't need to get a religious answer from the parish priest. All of us have the human capacity to observe the world systematically and draw inferences on the basis of those observations. If you consider that that's where science came from, and then crystallized further during the American Revolution and the French Revolution, we have this sense of equality that emerges from positivist thinking that has a political dimension and a social dimension. So if science's origins are as an engagement with the metaphysical world and the world of religion in sequence, then interpretive thinking emerges out of an engagement with positivism. Each one of them speaks to the limitations of its foregoing way of thinking. And so this is what brings us both to the notion of systematicity as the way in which science is distinguished from faith, and testability, or conducted with an attitude of doubt, is also a way of reframing that notion of whether knowledge is universal, generalizable, or there is some other dimension that we need to engage.
Let's pick up on this point of generalizability, because in the third chapter of the book, you speak to the importance of contextuality for interpretive social scientific work. And you emphasize that for interpretive researchers, conceptualization emerges out of the inquiry in the research site and through a different kind of engagement with research subjects of that associated with its epistemological others. Does that attention to contextuality occlude that social scientific goal of generalizability? How do you balance a concern for both and avoid criticism that you're engaging a kind of relativistic interpretive project?
Well, one way, a really essential way, is to challenge what might be called the politics of generalizability. I mean, the way that's normally talked about is it's up to the researcher to show that it's generalizable. Well, what if we flip it and say, if the researcher provides the context in a thick description, as well as the findings that fit that context, then a reader can assess whether those findings make sense in their own context. If you flip generalizability in that way, it's much more democratic.
The other thing that I would ask is, why is relativism a problem? This has become a boogeyman, and I really don't understand what makes it so challenging, unless it is that it challenges the presumption that we can arrive at a singular truth. From that perspective, then relativism is seriously a problem. But again, if one looks around, if one lives life, one understands that life is not singular. Social realities are not singular. In that case, there are differences. There are multiple experiences, multiple possible ways of making sense of those experiences. And the boogeyman of relativity disappears.
And one way to understand that is to look at the quite different attitudes of interpretivists and positivists to the word ambiguity. Mm. So for positivists, ambiguity is the enemy. Right? Oh, my dear. Oh, goodness. I have to get my measure as precise as possible. For interpretivists, ambiguity is an opportunity. Oh, wow. Look at this symbol. One group interprets that symbol in this way, but another group looks at that same symbol and understands it differently. How can that be? So it becomes a research question that gets you to look at how different communities think about their worlds.
On that note, Perry Devora, let's take a short break here for a sponsor's announcement. And when we come back, we'll talk about causal inference, discuss some of the rhythms of interpretive research that you speak to in the book, trustworthiness, and perhaps, if we have time, about how the book has been received.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Welcome back to the inaugural episode in our special series, New Books in Interpretive Social Science, with Peregrine Schwarzschee and Devorah Yanow, authors of Interpretive Research Design, published in 2012 as the first in the Routledge series in Interpretive Methods. Peri, Devorah, before we stopped, we got to this question of variables, and I'm left with the image of the open-mouthed social scientist asking where they've gone. One reason that social scientists insist upon identifying and isolating variables is that they want to be able to infer causality. How do you go about doing that in interpretive work if you're not adopting that mode of inquiry? And more specifically, to go to a part of the third chapter in the book, how do you distinguish what you characterize as constitutive causality from mechanical or mechanistic causality?
The mechanistic causality is directly related to the independent variables or separate factors, if you're doing positivist qualitative research. And that conception of causality is not crazy. And I think many of us accept it because we're embodied and we watch what happens when we move our bodies, when we knock a glass of water off the table. So it's not that that vision of causality is crazy, but it's very, very limited. So what we need to do is, especially for the social sciences, is we need to expand our vision of causality. Because if you think about constitutive causality, it's about how people understand who they are. And so if you understand how people think of who they are, that seems in some senses to, dare I say, predict how they might behave, how they might conduct themselves. But there's no billiard ball there. And I think that form of causality is powerful.
How is this distinction between mechanistic and constitutive causality related to what you refer to as the goal of interpretive research being explanatory description rather than an emphasis on prediction?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that question. Part of it has to do with the purposes of research. So the way I present the purposes of positivist research is in terms of prediction and control. Interpretivists are interested in explanation, but often that might be tied to some form of emancipation. We haven't developed this in the book, but there is a politics to the use of research results. And I think it's pretty evident that many social scientists have served the state. And maybe it's what brings people to interpretive analysis is a deep interest in power and how power forms us and how power can be resisted.
We have actually hesitated to advance that kind of argument. Our colleagues and friends Helen Ingram and Anne Schneider have, in a couple of articles, argued that social constructionist approaches in public policy are more democratic. John Dreizack advances that same argument also with respect to deliberative policy analysis. All three of them, if I understand the argument correctly, are saying that interpretive approaches are much more encompassing of a broader range of people, as well as ideas. My spin on that would be that interpretive research decenters the researcher as the only expert in the room. What interpretive researchers are expert in is ways of asking questions or observing, of drawing inferences from their participation. But many more people who are experts in their own lives are then drawn into the research. That said, I find myself, and I don't know, Peri, that we've talked about this, but I find a kind of a superior attitude embedded at least in the language of those arguments.
Mm.
And perhaps because of those reasons, we've hesitated to go very far down that road.
One thing that I do find, if not emancipatory, challenging is the flipping of generalizability,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I think the way generalizability is used now is a power play. I'm the expert. You manage your office, but I've got my best practices for you based on research. And I think that fails because it disrespects the people who know their own context. So that I find a little more democratic.
Let's say that I'm a new researcher. I'm persuaded by the merits of interpretive research design. I'm aware that there are many different possible ways of going about doing interpretive social science. How do I get started?
Often the starting point for research is a surprise. This is the idea of abductive reasoning. In particular, and I think this is not uncommon among people doing interpretive research, when the research question emerges from one's own lived experience, often it's something that one hadn't expected to find quite, that leads one to start asking, and a research question and a research project emerge out of that. So if I were approached by a new scholar, I would start engaging that person along those lines. What prompted you to think about this as a possible topic? And then if I hear something that sounds like a puzzle or a tension or a surprise, I'll pursue that.
Yeah, I work explicitly with students to think about surprises, to welcome surprises, to examine why the literature they're reading about Congress doesn't match their internship experience. And what does that mean for what is going on in the literature? The puzzle part is important to motivating. I mean, if you really care about the puzzle, then you're in it for the long haul, which is what you need, especially if you're a dissertation student. I hope most scholars are still feeling that way, that they care about their research projects and solving intellectual puzzles, ethical puzzles, political puzzles.
A lot of us got into this academic business because we wanted to make the world a better place to live. And for reasons that I am not entirely clear about, that motivation, that, as you, Perry, you used the phrase the other day, having skin in the game, that is, shall I say, educated out of one in a couple of years of graduate school coursework before one gets to one's own research. By focusing on puzzles, tensions, surprises, and so forth, we can work somehow to get graduate students and others back to asking, why did I get into this business? What did I see or what did I experience that drew me to graduate school because I had a problem that I wanted to solve?
So what do you tell the graduate student who says, I'd love to do interpretive work, but my supervisor won't let me, or my department is against the idea?
We are here at a summer methods school that draws students from all over the world. We teach different interpretive courses, interpretive methods courses, and one has to be acutely aware of a different kind of politics of science. And that is, at the end of the week, we're going to our respective homes and the students are going back to their departmental homes. We try to be very careful in giving advice in the face of these kinds of realities. I don't think either of us is a Pollyanna. I think we have our feet on the ground and we're very attuned to the political dynamics of doing a doctorate. And we try to help students to articulate their own path in the face of these kinds of issues.
And to provide them with the vocabulary to respond to their supervisors who say, is this generalizable? Is it reliable? And then there's also look, you're smart people. We're all smart people in this room. We could go elsewhere and make a lot more money. Why are you here? Aren't you here because you're passionate about the ideas and the ways in which new knowledge can assist people?
So as we wind down, let's return to standards and vocabulary. Chapter 6 of the book, I want to point to its main title, Designing for Trustworthiness. And here again, against the conventions of social science and perhaps political science especially, where the language of reliability, as you mentioned, Perry, validity and replicability is dominant, you insist on trustworthiness as an alternative criterion for assessing the quality of our work. What is trustworthiness, and how can it enable different kinds of assessments of interpretivist research from those that call for reliability, validity, and replicability?
Well, if you think about the word, it is a relational word, and it's a relationship between an author and the readers. Do the readers trust what I have to say? How can I persuade them? How can I demonstrate that what I have done has been systematic and that I haven't been an ideologue? I have an attitude of doubt. How can I persuade them? And then we write to some extent about how to do that. We've written elsewhere about how don't just name the standards, put them into your research from the beginning to the end. So you can't have thick description in your manuscript if you haven't had thick description in your field notes. You can't have reflexivity in your manuscript unless you've done it along the way during the research process.
There's a distinction that's drawn in circles that think about writing and how writing is accomplished. It's a distinction between showing and telling, where telling is the saying so, the declaration, this is trustworthy research. The reader then says, well, how is it trustworthy? And one has to show it through the caliber, the quality of the work that one presents. But I want to take the answer in a little bit different direction as well. Earlier in my career, maybe before I met Perry and started working on these sorts of things, but going back to my own doctoral work and even before that, I was very much like Timothy Pacherat, faced with the question, but where are your variables? I was challenged that my research wasn't rigorous, that it wasn't generalizable, and I kept puzzling over how to respond to those kinds of challenges. I came to realize two things. The first was I was never going to be able to win the argument if I became defensive in trying to show that my research was rigorous, because it would never be rigorous in the way that my interlocutor expected it to be rigorous. In other words, my interlocutor's expectations were based on receiving particular kinds of answers that I could never give, because the character of my research was different from the character of the research that the concept of rigor emerges from. This then led me to start trying to think, what could I answer that wouldn't be a defensive response, but rather would assert what questions about rigor, generalizability, reliability, et cetera, were after. And it seemed to me that all of these concepts were reaching for the notion of trustworthiness. In this thinking, I'm imagining that I was influenced by the kinds of students I was teaching at the time. This was in California at one of the state university campuses in a graduate program in public administration. My students, as practitioners, would want their answers based on whatever research they had been doing to be trustworthy, because in the role of a department head or in the role of city manager, they would want people carrying out the findings from their research to be doing work that was trustworthy, that other people in the department could trust, that residents of the cities could trust. This notion of trustworthiness has a very practical dimension as well. We want our research, we need our research to be trustworthy, because it can lead to particular actions. If the research isn't trustworthy, then the actions that are based on that research are likely to be untrustworthy.
You end the book with an appeal for researchers to speak across epistemic communities. And in doing so, you also offer a gentle critique of mixed methods research, or perhaps not so gentle. Why is it that you're concerned to emphasize this need to speak across epistemic communities? And why also is the mixing of methods not necessarily the way to go about it?
It's funny you should ask that. We just had a whole session on this question here at the Summer Methods School. If you're mixing methods within the same methodological framework, within interpretivism or within positivism, there's really no problem because you have kind of consistent philosophical ground under your feet.
So ethnographic research, for example, that also draws on interviews and also may draw on analyzing research question relevant documents, there is an example of a mixture of methods, and yet observation, participation, talking to people, and document analysis that is all done within a phenomenological hermeneutic makes sense, or that which is done in keeping with realist objectivist presuppositions makes sense.
I think the clearest example here is the position on the researcher role. Positivists want an objective researcher who finds a neutral place to stand. Interpretivists reject that that is possible and replace objectivity with reflexivity. How can you hold both of those positions simultaneously? Well, you can't. Your research looks very different if you embrace reflexivity versus objectivity. It has implications from how you design the research to how you generate the evidence and on down the line.
We have had encounters with our colleagues and friends, Joe Soss and Sandy Schramm, both of whom do policy-related research, specifically within the field of social welfare policy. And they argue that the legislators whose views they want to change, who are adopting public policies that affect the lives of people, that those legislators only will be influenced by realist, objectivist, quantitative research results. And so they argue, Sandy Schramm in particular, that he can mix quantitative work with a more qualitative interpretive sort of work. My argument in return, bracketing for the moment the reality of the perception that lawmakers will only value quantitative, objectivist, realist research, is that when they do these different kinds of research, the actual research question changes. So certain kinds of research questions are usefully answered by statistical evidence. Other research questions are more usefully answered by participant observation-based research. Combining the two into the same study, let's say presenting the research findings in different chapters, does not make it a mixed methodology project or a mixed methods project, because the research question changes. So they're not using different methods to answer the same research question, but they're answering different research questions all within the same project. And I think that people who argue for mixed methods are ignoring the incommensurabilities that obtain to mixing methodologies, but they're also not quite recognizing these sometimes subtle shifts in the framing of a research question that takes place as they move from one kind of method to another.
So what's the alternative to have people speak across these epistemic communities as you would like them to?
Part of it depends on how broad the communities are. So I've observed that feminist researchers and environmentalist researchers care so much about their project that they'll read anything. They care about the substance. But there are other communities in which having the conversation across these epistemic divides is more challenging. If we can understand our methodological other, we'll be in a better position to debate them, to collaborate with them, depending on what the topic is.
And do you feel that this book has helped you do that?
We had one case where we wanted to invite editors to read the book.
Journal editors.
And the response of one person was very surprising to us because she was using a word that we had talked about and said, the book is not going to be this. She kept using the word polemic, that interpretive research design was a polemic. And we were shocked because we worked very hard to make sure that the tone was recognizing positivism as a legitimate way of doing research, but not the only way.
I should say that other members of that panel were equally surprised, along with us, at how this individual read a polemic argument into the tone of our book. But other than that, we've had lots of terrific response, in particular from doctoral students, but at the American Political Science meeting just last year, a senior professor came up to me in the ladies' room. She saw my name tag and she stopped me and she said, "I don't usually do this, but I have to tell you how influential, how significant your work has been for my own thinking." So we've fielded many responses like that. It's tremendously rewarding. And so I think we're feeling quite positive about the book.
And as you're the first co-authors that I've had the pleasure of interviewing for the New Books Network, I can't help but ask you in closing as well about the experience of co-authorship. How do you make decisions about what goes in and what comes out of a book like Interpretive Research Design, which, as you said, is necessarily a fairly thin volume? And how do you resolve disagreements or use them productively for the kind of publication and conversation that you want to have?
I think we just talk until we kind of come to an agreement. But part of it is that we bring different strengths to the book. I couldn't have written the book by myself. Devorah couldn't have written the book by herself. I bring my positivist background, experimental methods. I was hired to teach statistics at my current institution. I brought that knowledge to the table. Devorah brought her strong interpretive background to the table. So together we could fashion this bridge that would help to educate both people who are already doing interpretive research but maybe don't recognize it, and to enable them to educate others. And for positivists to say, rigor might look different.
The collaboration is based on our ability to see each other's strengths, to recognize them and to appreciate them. And also, we've developed a thicker skin. If we talk about the writing process, and don't forget, this is not the first book that we've written together. We started, as I said at the outset, with that article for 2002, which, by the way, we had submitted to another journal at the encouragement of a new member of the editorial board of that journal, right after she heard us present it at a conference as a conference paper. So we submitted it and we got roundly slapped upside the head by one review in particular, who more or less said, "These battles have been fought and lost years ago, and I see no reason to reopen them and revisit them now." So luckily, we didn't take no for an answer and spent much more time working together. So that collaboration goes back to 2000. And we have worked out a way of exchanging manuscripts, exchanging drafts, exchanging sections and paragraphs, and writing over each other's manuscripts, such that what emerges at the end is truly a collaborative project where it would be hard to say this was Perry's sentence and this was my sentence. Yeah.
And we'll push each other. So Devorah will say, "We'll complete that thought." And every once in a while I'll say, "But Devorah, don't you need this extra phrase?"
So at this point, we're very good at catching each other on our respective stuff. But this is also the developed skill that we bring to editing others' manuscripts in our series. And the process there is that each of us reads the manuscript, each of us writes up our respective comments, and then we spend hours. God bless Skype for facilitating this, because we are usually not co-located, talking through our respective comments and working out the kinds of comments that we want to give to the authors to help them articulate their arguments much more clearly, to the extent that they haven't done that already.
Well, I'm very glad that you were co-located today, and I'm looking forward to doing more interviews with other authors in the series in the not-too-distant future. But for now, Peregrine Schwartzsche and Devorah Yanar, I'd like to thank you very much for getting our New Books in Interpretive Social Science series started with this enlivening discussion of interpretive research design, the inaugural book in the Routledge series on interpretive methods.
You're most welcome, Nick. Thank you for the time.
Yes, thank you, Nick.
And thanks to everyone for listening in. I hope you'll join me, Nick Cheeseman, for the next in the series, when we'll feature an exemplary new study in interpretive social science.